All right, good afternoon, everybody. And so I'm here for Bio 241, Human Physiology. So I hope everybody else is here for that. Is anybody here for that? Nobody? I'm in the wrong spot. No, I don't think so. Okay, so that's me. And I want to just say a few opening comments about trying to add the class. I know there might be one or two students in here that want to add the class. And I can't issue any add codes from lecture. You have to find a spot in lab. And I know all the labs are full at the moment, and it is just highly unlikely that a lab instructor would be able to add a student. So I would say please go to the lab, but there's almost zero chance that if you have not added already or registered for this class that you will be able to register for it. And that's about the only thing I can say. But does anybody have any questions about trying to add the class at this point? Yeah. Yeah, and his class was full, so for the lab this morning, my answer is no, I can't add any students to that lab because it is full. And that's probably how it is for every lab, and the only thing we have to do is just double check when those labs come up, like on Wednesday, maybe tomorrow night, and that's it. There's none on Friday. Is there one on Friday?
There's
one on Friday morning. So those would be the only times. And the way to get in lecture is to find a place in lab. Okay, but it is just almost impossible. And quickly, we're having trouble. It's impossible to add students for various reasons, a number of different reasons. And I went to meetings all day on Friday, 8 hours of meetings, and everybody from the president on down was telling us why we can't add students, and I couldn't figure out what they were saying after listening to them all day long. So I wish I could help you out and find a way how to add students, but it just, there's a confluence of a number of very important factors that makes it impossible. One was that we had such phenomenal growth last year, so we just can't accommodate any other students. Okay. So, and the other thing is that only officially registered students can stay in class. So I know you might like to wish to stay and listen to lecture or something like that, but officially, I would have to ask you to leave. But I see everybody has a seat right here. All right, so, yeah. Okay, but the chances of being able to add the class are almost nil, unfortunately, at this point in time. So thanks for showing up, but to ask the next lab class to find out if there is room. Okay, sorry about that. Okay, well, before I get started, I want to say, oh, a question. Oh, it's even worse for anatomy class. Yeah, it's the same. Okay, and don't forget, there are prerequisites for this class, which I'll go over again, which is what? Who knows a prerequisite for this class?
Anatomy,
right. I have known students to do well in this class who have not taken anatomy, but it's fairly rare. And every student that I said, please take anatomy first and chemistry first before taking this class, there isn't a single student that has not thanked me for giving them that advice. All right, so please, sometimes I know you hate to put off taking a class for a semester or something, but that seems to be really good advice. Yeah, I know. That's right. If you got in, that's something else to think about. Other people are facing deadlines. If they want to apply to a program, they have to have these courses done by January. You don't have a choice. But if you want to get the best grade possible, then it's worthwhile to follow my advice. Okay, so before we get started, I was saying that we are lucky in here because we do have supplemental instruction with this course. So not only can you come to lecture to learn stuff, you can go to lab to learn stuff, but we also have extracurricular learning opportunities. We have a supplemental instruction leader, Lynn Selden, who is right here, and so I want to introduce her, invite her up, and she's going to tell you a little bit about supplemental instruction with this class. And as she's coming up, I want to pass out the sign-in sheet. Please sign this, pass it around the room, and so this is just your receipt that you were in class.
And then
what the actual sessions do is we take what's going on in the classroom, we break it down, and we facilitate and help you build study skills. It's open to anybody, it's free, it's voluntary. The other portion I want to know is typically what we try to do is it's academic, it's part of your academic success. We will help you language building skills in terms of vocabulary. We do various worksheets to help broaden your understanding of what's going on very fast. We do practice tests. But we also have you participate. Studies have found that those who teach retain 95% of what they teach. So that helps. The spotlight's not always on you. It's on everybody to work together to understand the material. The sad news is typically the hard courses, the high caliber of the coursework that is done here is wonderful. What you learn is very thorough. This is not an easy course, a very challenging course. And those that set goals and high goals can be able to attain them. It also sometimes happens that you can look around the room and those that don't do the material roughly somewhere between 30 and 50% of your classes may not be a C or above. So what they have found is that SI instruction is and regularly, so they say is increasing anywhere from a half a point to a fourth grade more. Those that attend on a regular 12 session, they discovered you can do a full grade better. For those of you going into medical application or some kind of medical field, you really want your A and your B. You want the strong knowledge that comes from this course. This is a wonderful course. You will be challenged. There are some handouts. I will be putting three ones up front. This will have our first session. Is on Thursday to the 3:30 in business. My email is lselden@cclrc.info. I have an information sheet. Also, with all that information on it, I will be leaving here promptly at 3:20 when this is over, so I want you to hold on to these until Wednesday. Typically, I will always be here after class. It's just today I have an appointment for. I also want you to know that every week I'm putting up, either on this board or in our SI session, a study tip. The one thing you can do for yourself is to read the material prior to coming to lecture. You will learn in Chapter 8, I believe, on memory. What happens is it goes through the eye, through your vision, and then it's stored in the brain. As you hear it, you get recalled. You're hearing it auditorily, and you're building on that knowledge. That way, after you've read the material, heard the material, and if you don't understand something, Dr. Gober has his office hours, and then in SI, you can conquer any of the problems you may have. Anything that I can't answer, that you can't answer, the text can't answer,
we have Google.
Yes. So, everybody is welcome. I highly recommend that you come. We just got our emails this morning. So, if you have any problems, it should be open if you have any questions. I'm going to pass these around and put them down your way. Also, the library on the second floor, if you haven't bought your text, and you want to stay ahead, they have a textbook for the coursework. You cannot check it out of the library, but you can leave it in house for 2 hours. So if you haven't purchased your text and you're waiting for them to come in, I don't know what the text situation is, you do have a resource in the library on the second floor. There are copy machines, you can do the copy work there too. So we'll do that copy. Again, return these on Wednesday, and I will be available when you have questions.
Take one, pass it back, pass it sideways. Oh, I gave you too many. Yeah, pass one there, pass those back. Take one, pass those back. Take one, pass those, the rest back. All right, so there's two handouts going around. Try to make sure that you get a copy of each of those. All right, so this is a web-enhanced class. And that means that you can find a lot of materials on the internet, and the virtual classroom that I'm using mostly is called Blackboard, and you all are, if you're registered for this class, are enrolled in Blackboard. So you need your student ID number and a password to get into Blackboard, and then for all the classes that you're taking, if they have, those instructors have content and Blackboard will show up, and you just click on this class, and you can get to, for instance, a syllabus, study guides, lecture slides, all of that information. And so there might be some people that aren't familiar with Blackboard. I would guess most of the students in here are, so I didn't log in just yet, but this is the website for Blackboard. It's not www anything, it's just straight cypresscollege.blackboard.com. And that takes you to this login page. Click log on and put your information into the account, which you should have. And everybody's username starts with that funny ampersand signal and then your student ID number. Put that in. I'm going to blank the slide. I'll put mine in. Okay, and then the password. Password should be the same one that you use for WebStar. It may or may not be. If it's not, then I know how to change it. You could see me after class or office hours, for instance. Okay, so there is my login information right there, gone. And this is what, a human physiology class of some kind, like, for instance, this one looks good. Okay, so this is a screen you're going to come to, and what I want to show you is first the syllabus. So here's the course syllabus, and you notice that the cursor will change from an arrow to a hand when it is over an executable statement. So if we click on this, this is going to either open or download or do something with this particular file. What could you tell me about this file right here? What's on the very last? What's on the suffix of this particular link right here? You see a .doc, and that just means that it's a Microsoft Word document, .doc. So that's the kind of program that you would have to have on your computer. Okay, if you don't have that, I can show you how to get a free Microsoft Word reader on your computer so that you can look at that. So you can open it up in this window, or actually there's a better way of doing this. For instance, I recommend that you download this file to your computer. All right, so how would you download this? You would select Save Target As. And to get to that menu, you can use the right-hand mouse button to do that. Instead of the left-hand, which is the mouse button that you usually do when you're mousing around, but use the right-hand mouse button, put it over that link, right-hand click it, and it will say open a new window or save target as, and that's what you want to do, save target as. And here's the name of the file, and what should we clutter up here on this computer? How about, let's just put it on the desktop. All right, so you might want to create a folder in your computer, 241, and say save, and then open. Here it is. Okay, now I've made hard copies of this syllabus for everybody, but I don't have them. Maybe by Wednesday I'll have them. And then again, maybe not. We'll see. Okay, but nonetheless, you have access to all of this information via Blackboard. So it's got contact information, my phone number. This is a website that I will put some information on. Most of it will be in Blackboard, however. Most importantly, look at the office hours. On Monday and Wednesday, I'm going to be in my office. That's room 265. Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'm going to be in the anatomy lab. That's up on the third floor. You all know where that is. You might not ever want to go back up there again and see me, but that's where I'm going to be, and I just hold that as an open lab for all of my anatomy students or anybody that's taking anatomy. Okay, required materials. Textbook. You need Human Physiology by Fox, and that's the 10th edition. And that's this book right here. So you can kind of see what it looks like. I think I gave you the ISBN numbers, so you can check it out online or across the street or wherever. So this is the 10th edition right here. And there are copies in the reserve section of the library that was mentioned to you before. So if you don't want to lug this textbook around with you to campus every day, you should be able to check it out of the reserve section of the library. That's on the second floor of the library for 2 hours. You can't take it out, but for 2 hours you can have it. You need the green lab book called Integrate. Does anybody have that with them right now? If you do have that, hold it up if it's not buried away someplace. It's just a nice green book. Oh, there's one. There's one. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and there's another one. Good. Hopefully that's less than $100. Is it less than $100?
Yeah, 32.
32. Okay, that's a good deal. Some other materials like Physio EX, they used to print that. I don't know if it's still in print anymore or not, so I think we're photocopying that and passing it out in lab, so I don't think you have to buy that. All right, what else do you need? A Cypress College picture ID card. That's going to be required when you take a test. When you hand me your test, I want to see your Cypress College picture ID. Plus, if you ever want to check anything out of the library, you will need that. So a driver's license won't work in the library. And if you only have a driver's license and you want to check something out of the reserve section, don't get mad at the librarian because their boss is telling them only check out material to people that have a Cypress College picture ID. And that's easy to get. Probably takes less than 10 minutes at student services, but it does cost $2.50. An email account. You want an email account? For Blackboard, because I'll send a note, I'll send out notices, emails, maybe once a week, twice a week, something like that. And make sure that when you log into Blackboard, you put a correct and functioning email address in there. And it may or may not transfer from WebStar. If you put an email address in WebStar, sometimes it gets lost when it goes over to Blackboard. So just double check. And then here are a couple links for the Gateway page as well as Blackboard. Okay. I'm not going to read much of these things right here, except prerequisites are what? Anatomy, either 230, 231, or Bio 210. And a good recommendation is what? Chemistry, which is going to be one of the fundamental parts of this class, biochemistry. Attendance, make sure that you keep coming to class. So there'll be sign-in sheets, and if people stop coming to class, then they'll be forced to drop you. Okay, that's just a state law. And let's see, the last day to withdraw from the course without a grade, which means a W, is November 19th. That's quite a ways off. Okay, grading. 75% of your course grade is going to be from lecture tests, 25% from laboratory. And that's just by the number of hours. So lab quizzes, you're going to have a number of lab quizzes, and they're all going to total to 160 points. And you'll have to work with your lab instructor as to how what the nature of those quizzes are going to be, but probably you'll get a quiz every week. And lecture tests, they're going to be 5 lecture tests worth 100 points. So if we add that together, that looks like about 660 points, and the grading scale is just a simple 90, 80, 70 grade scale. But a D drops down to 55%. I don't think that's going to really affect anybody's interest one way or the other, right, instead of 60%. Academic honesty policy for quizzes and lab and tests. Make sure that you do your own work in here. It's just an individual effort, and it is closed book and no notes, so it's just information that you have in your mind. All right, so no outside sources. And I turned my cell phone off before I started lecturing, and of course you should do that, and especially during tests. Please do that. All right, I think you should just read all this other material that I put in here. The only other thing that's sort of interesting, let's see, that's sort of interesting, where do I have it? Maybe I don't even have it in here. Oh yeah, number 4 over here. Okay, so right now, I'm recording lectures. It's this little device that I have right here. And it used to be that I had to burn these audio tracks and put them on a CD in the library. But this semester, I'll be able to upload them to the web directly, and you can download them from the web and not have to go to the LLRC. And the only slight hesitation I have in saying that is I got to find my password to my web page first before I can do that. But I'm sure it's around someplace. All right, so that will make life easy. So even over Thanksgiving break, if you travel to Florida or something, you'll be able to get the lectures of that week really anywhere in the world. So that's kind of handy. Yeah, I do tape all my lectures, maybe not 100% of the time because sometimes the battery goes dead, but if I remember to bring new batteries and I don't drop the recorder or, you know, something like that, then it will be recorded. It picks my voice up very nicely, but it doesn't pick up student comments. So You still should be polite, all right, even though the recorder isn't picking your voice up, but sometimes I don't repeat the question. So you might remind me to repeat the question. Okay, so here's a tentative class schedule, and we can see a number of different column headings right here. We have week, we got date, topic, the text reading, and then over here we have score. So the first column is what, number of weeks? How many weeks do we have in the course? Can you read this table? It is 18 weeks, right? So we got 18 weeks. And for instance, what's the date of your first exam? September 10th, right? So your first exam, it's going to be on a Wednesday. That's September 10th right over here. All right, so today we're going to do introduction and homeostasis. Homeostasis is also a topic, a very important topic that you cover in lab this week. But I have some comments I want to make in lecture, but the lab presentation is probably more important than what I cover. It's going to be more in-depth than I have time in lecture right here on this very first day. And you will cover chapter 1 for today. And then the topic on Wednesday is going to be what? Chemistry, right? We're going to start talking about chemistry for a couple of days. All right, then we got the Labor Day holiday. And then on that first exam, what chapters are going to be covered? Yeah, 1, 2, 3, and 6. So we're going to skip around a little bit. So those are the chapters that will be on the first test. But notice, what did I say about the class schedule? It is tentative. And so depending on the class and the kinds of questions we get, I may or may not follow this schedule to a T. We'll have to modify it as we go along. So I can't guarantee you precisely that all these chapters will be on this test. All right, but that's a pretty good guess at this point in time. Okay. So that's this schedule over here. And then on the next page, I have the schedule for lab. These are the labs that you're going to be doing during approximately these weeks right here. Okay, because there are different holidays. So that's the syllabus, and you can get this through your Blackboard account. Okay, I passed something else out to you, and that is the weekly study plan. I don't know if you've worked anything like this before. All right, but say if I want to save this weekly study plan, what kind of program is this? What kind of file is the weekly study plan? Somebody's got to tell me. Yeah, it's a Word document, because you see why. The .doc. All right, we're going to look at a lot of words in physiology, and their meaning is going to be changed depending on the prefix and suffix that we attach to them. So this is nothing new. The .doc just means that it's a Microsoft Word program. It has nothing to do with physiology, but we'll learn physiology nomenclature. So if I want to download this to my computer, what do I do? Right-click it, right? Right-click it and then say Save Target As, and I'll put it on the desktop again, and it's there already. I fell asleep. All right, so what does it say right here? Success is not an accident. All right, a failure to plan is a plan to fail. You need a plan. So a lot of people don't have a plan, and they think they don't have a plan. But if you don't have a plan, what do you have a plan for? Failure, right? So it's good to have a plan. So for any kind of college course, this is just standard operating procedure. For every 1 hour that you attend class, you should study 3 hours outside class. That's just the general rule. If you're not familiar with the material, guess what? It's got to be a little bit more. All right, so for this class, this is the number of hours that you need to study every week. And this is just to get a good passing grade, but not necessarily an A or a B. That's 18 hours outside class. So that's a lot of study time. So what I gave you right here is just a little table that shows the days of the week, and then I broke the days down into morning, afternoon, evening, and night. This may work for you. And then in parentheses here, I put what I might think would be okay times, the amount of time for you to study during that part of the day. So Sunday morning, 1.5 hours. And during these periods of time right here, between morning and night, what's the biggest number that you see? What's the longest study time that you see during any of these periods? 1.5 hours, that's right. Don't study for any longer than 1.5 hours because our brain fatigues. And it's almost like wasted time. You really don't learn anything after about 1.5 hours. Okay? So break your study time into shorter periods more frequently rather than one really big long period. Who's ever crammed for a test the night before? Like between 11 o'clock at night and 2 o'clock in the morning? Good luck. Hopefully you passed. Chances are you didn't pass. Okay? Because our brains just don't work that way. All right, so this is a proposed schedule. Not for me, all right, but for you, you should put down before, like tonight, put down in this table right here where you want to study and work it out so that you get about 18 hours. And then as the week progresses, what should you do? Actually make a log of when you are studying, all right, so that you can keep track and see if you're meeting your expectations. Because what grade do you all want right now? You all want an A, right? But that just won't happen automatically. This is maybe a little technique that you can use to help you attain that goal. And for instance, I would like for you to show this table right here after you fill it in with your actual hours and your proposed schedule. Share it with your lab instructor. Share it with me and see how things are going. If you're getting 100% on a test and you're studying 18 hours, guess what you could do? You could probably drop down to like 17.5 hours or something, right? Okay? And maybe do some other stuff. All right, but if you're only getting a C and you're studying 18 hours, one of the things that you could do is increase your study time, but there are other things that you can do too, is like study correctly, study the right material, and that's where lab instructors and myself will help you. But this is a good starting point. So at the end of the semester, how many of these tables should you have? 18. That's right. Okay, and you can print all 18 of these out. Okay. All right. So who's got a question? Any questions so far regarding this material? No. Okay. Well, I think I'm going to start today's lecture. So where can I find today's lecture? Let's see where I have today's lecture. I'm not sure where I have. How about course documents? Lecture PowerPoint slides. All right, so you can click on that. I left click because I just want to go to this particular folder on web Blackboard. And then here's chapter 1, lecture PowerPoint. If I want to download this to my computer, what do? Right click. And do what? Save target as. Okay, PowerPoint. Oh, this desktop's going to get really cluttered with stuff. And then we're going to say open. Okay, so to look at these PowerPoints, you do need Microsoft PowerPoint, but there's also a free viewer, and I think I have a link on this Blackboard site to get the free viewer. With the free viewer, it will only print out one slide per page, and some of the lectures have like 70 pages on them, so that's a little bit problematic. I think the first floor of the library has the full-blown PowerPoint product so that you can put a number of slides on one page. You can format it as opposed to one slide per page. The second floor does not have that option. So go down to the first floor to print out the PowerPoints if you're going to do that. And I would print them out in black and white, of course. That's usually what the case will be. All right, so does anybody have any questions so far? If you're not sure how to get to Blackboard or if your account works, let's take a look at it tonight before you leave or this afternoon before you leave to make sure that you know what your password is. If you don't know what your password is, I can put one in there for you and work things over. The only thing that you'll need to know for sure is your Cypress College ID number to do that. But I could probably find that too for you. Yeah. That's a good question. I don't know if that will work in our library or not. The Fullerton College one? I would accept it for tests. Yeah, but I don't know if it works in the library. Yeah, I'm recording right now. Yeah, so I'm recording the lectures. And I won't put it on the web tonight, but probably this week I will. So you'll be able to download them. They're big files, so you won't be able to do it probably with a modem, a telephone modem. You'd probably want some kind of high-speed internet connection of some kind. to do that, DSL or cable, something like that, because they're about 16 megabytes per lecture. Okay. All right, well, let's start with a couple let me start the program. Okay. Let's start with a couple definitions, physiology versus pathophysiology. You pretty much know the difference between anatomy and physiology already. What is anatomy? It's not on the slide. That's a scientific study of structure. And I'm using that really loaded term, scientific study, because that has a lot of importance to us, and we're going to find out what that means in just a couple slides. And physiology is what? It's the scientific study of function, how things function in our bodies. And of course, there's always a relationship between structure and function. Like, in order for us to understand how we speak, we need to know the muscles of our face, the bone structures of our head, so that we can articulate and have an oral communication, have an oral language, right? And we can speak because of our particular anatomy compared to insects or birds or something like that. Okay, so physiology is function to maintain life. Pathophysiology is a scientific study of how physiologic processes are altered by disease state or by injury. Oh, I got to change my arrow, I forgot. Pointer options. Arrow options. Ah, there we go. Okay. All right, so pathophysiology is how our body changes when it's in a disease state. So when certain kinds of parameters deviate from normal, like what kind of parameter do we measure all the time to see if we're in a disease state? Like body temperature, right? Our body temperature is regulated very closely, should be about, 98.6. And if it gets too cold, what do we call that? It's a disease state. When you get too cold, it's called hypothermia. That's lethal. If you get too hot, that's hyperthermia, and that can be just as lethal depending on how high your temperature gets. Okay? And so studying hypothermia or hyperthermia, that's pathophysiology. That's studying those abnormal states. Okay, so I want to go over a little bit of the scientific method with you, because we said that physiology is a scientific study. It's just a very particular, very disciplined study of functioning in our bodies. And everything that you're going to read in your textbook, it might seem like it's coming from outer space or something really bizarre, but everything that's in your book has been proven by the scientific method, which is a very rigorous method, and we believe that to be true under the circumstances or under the conditions that we're going to be talking about. Right? So nobody is making anything up in your book at all. It's all been proven via a scientific method. Well, what is that scientific method? Well, first, you have to form some kind of testable hypothesis about your everyday observations. So you might be living your life, and maybe you're driving to school every morning, and sometimes you leave at 7:45 in the morning, and sometimes you leave at 8 o'clock, and when you leave at 8 o'clock, it might take you a half hour longer to get to class just by leaving a couple minutes later. There's a lot of traffic, and so you're going to say, oh, well, I have a hypothesis. I'll just leave a couple minutes earlier, and my transit time is going to be way reduced. Probably some of you noticed that. I know I took advantage of that this morning myself. Okay, so that's just a guess on your part. You haven't really performed any of these other steps in the scientific method, and that is conduct and analyze experiments to test the hypothesis. So if that's your guess, right, leaving a little bit early saves you a lot of time in commuting, how can you test that hypothesis, that guess on your part? You can leave maybe five times at that early hour, and then five times on that late hour, and measure how long it takes you to get to class, and then take the average and compare those two numbers. Okay? So, for a scientific method, you have to come up with some kind of experiment that you can actually conduct, right? And it's real important to be able to collect quantitative information, some numbers that you can actually measure. And in this particular case, what was the quantitative information that you could measure with a fancy instrument? And that was a time with a nice stopwatch, right? So that's really easy to do. there are some experiments that you just can't do because you can't measure them. Okay. Once you collect the data, then you have to draw conclusions about whether or not the results support the hypothesis. So maybe your transit time was shortened by 15 minutes, so that supports your hypothesis, and you're probably pretty happy with that. But maybe you were proven wrong. Maybe it takes you just as long to get to work or to school, no matter when you left the house. All right, so then you have to reject that hypothesis. All right, but if you do find experimental results that supports the hypothesis and other people are able to reproduce that hypothesis, okay, then it can be developed into what we call a theory. And this is actually pretty important. So a theory is a general statement explaining some phenomena of the natural world that's based on a proven hypothesis. I know a lot of times in everyday English language, you might have a hunch, and when people have a hunch or a guess about something, they say, oh, you know what, I got a theory about that. All right, so, but what should they really be saying? If you have a guess that's not been proven by experiments, what is it really? Is it a theory? It's a hypothesis. That's right. So a lot of people misuse these terms. Something can only be a theory if it's been proven, right, by experimental evidence. All right, proven by stipulating these hypotheses and then testing the hypothesis. And I guess we don't like to use that word hypothesis because it's so big and bulky. Okay. All right, so a theory is really kind of a special thing. All right, so all of the information that's presented in your book has gone through all of these steps right here. So how do we go about testing a particular hypothesis? Well, basically, we need to have, for instance, if we're going to be testing for a drug, to see if a drug is efficacious, if it's going to have the particular effect that we want, okay, we need to give that drug to a class of patients that we believe that's going to be helped by that drug, and another class of patients, which should be exactly the same as the first, will be given what we call a placebo. And that's what we're going to call a control group. Because anytime you do something for somebody, that's going to be a positive thing that's going to influence their life. And even if it has a null effect, just your interaction with them might help them into a healthy situation. Okay, but we're not interested in that interaction. We want to actually measure the effect of what? That one particular drug. So we have to have an experimental group that gets the drug and a control group that's exactly the same as the experimental group, but they get the placebo. Right? And then we like to quantitatively measure how these two substances affect these two different control groups. And whoever is administering those medications or the sham medication or placebo should not know, okay, which is which, right? Because if who's ever dispensing the drugs, if they know which one is which, then their interaction is going to be different, right? Because people always want to help somebody out, and if you know a drug you suspect is going to help them, you'll have a much better attitude as opposed to if you're just giving a placebo to somebody. Right, so just that interaction will affect the outcome of the experiment. So who's ever doing that should not know. That's what that blindly means. Okay. So then that effect gets canceled out of the study. And then the results are analyzed using statistics. And again, the use of statistics takes the bias out of the measurement and the analysis of the data. Okay. So that it becomes just a mathematical tool and devoid of human impression. Okay, human impression is important. We'll talk about that some, but not necessarily for the scientific method. Okay, so what is the bottom line? What does the scientific method give us? I would like for you to have some, why do we go through all this trouble? Why do we set up experimental groups and control groups and find people to administer drugs that have no idea what's going on and employ the statistics and write a hypothesis and then make sure other people are able to duplicate these results before we come up with a theory? What's the purpose of scientific method?
Prove something.
Yeah, to prove something, but The reason for scientific method is because we like to have dependable information, right? We like to have information that rings true, that holds its value over time. I could give you a lot of impressions, a lot of advice, okay? But unless it's been proven in a scientific way, then I might not have a lot of confidence in how good it is. With a scientific method, you should have a lot of confidence that it is true and that it will be useful in your life. If it has come about without scientific method, then it may or may not have a lot of value to your life. Okay, so I might say, well, you know what? If you drink a gallon of water every day, you won't have cardiovascular disease. Well, that may be true, but how would we find out if that's really true or not? We would have to apply that hypothesis to the scientific method to find out. And chances are, it probably is a lot better for your kidneys than it is for your heart. But your kidneys are connected to your heart, so who knows what the interaction there really would be. But you would have to, okay, test that. All right, so the bottom line for scientific method is to come up with dependable information, information you can trust and information you can count on. All right, so let's talk about drugs for just a little bit. When a new drug is suggested by experiments, all right, it's got to be tested for effectiveness and toxicity, right? And first, it's tested with systems, biological systems, that really make no difference or not if the drug doesn't work out, or perhaps maybe it's even harmful. All right, so we want to test these things in just a tissue culture first, right? We don't want to take a drug and just give it to somebody because it might be harmful to them, and that would be terrible. So first, a drug is tested in tissue culture. And if it passes tests for tissue culture, then we actually give it to a living organism, like rats and mice and maybe other organisms, to see what the effects are in a real living biological system. And if it still passes, then it can go on to other kinds of tests. So there is some good rationale for using animal experimentation, because we learn how drugs work within living systems. Okay. So, before any drug comes to market where we prescribe that for humans, look at all the different trials that have to go through, the different phases. All right, so phase one trials, toxicity and metabolism is tested in healthy human volunteers. But this is after what? The testing in tissue culture and other animal models. So the first test is in what? Healthy human volunteers to see if it affects them poorly. Phase two trials, effectiveness and toxicity tested in a target population, all right, one that has a disease state that we're trying to correct. Phase three trials, a widespread test of drug in a diverse population, because what do we have in the human population? Yes, look around the room. Is there anybody close to you looking in this room? Not really, okay? And we're going to find out why that is in the last part of this class. Okay, and then phase four trials, the drug is tested for other potential uses. All right, so this is all the job of the Food and Drug Administration to administer all of these tests, and you can see that it is a very extensive list, and it's very expensive. So a new drug usually takes about $100 million to bring to market before we're really convinced that it's going to be helpful to people. And then even after all these trials, right, there still can be possibilities for certain groups that it is not beneficial to them. But this phase four right here, okay, after the drug is being used, right, then the effects of that drug have to be reported to pharmacists to make sure that on a continuing basis that drug doesn't have any deleterious effects or harmful effects to people. All right, so FDA approval is very, very rigorous, and it's sort of based on the scientific method of extreme documentation and follow-up to make sure that the drugs are doing what they say they're doing and that they're not hurting anybody. So that's very, very important, as opposed to other kinds of substances that are classified as food supplements. Right, you can buy all kinds of food supplements, including vitamins, and you can read all kinds of interesting things that vitamins and food supplements do for people. But none of those things have gone through this FDA process right here to prove the safety and efficacy, that means the efficiency of those drugs working on your body. Okay? So, and again, all of the drugs that we're going to be looking at in this book have conformed to all of these kinds of studies. So again, in your book, we're actually not making anything up. We have a high degree of confidence that all these drugs are doing what they're doing. But I do want to say something about food supplements and maybe taking herbal medicines. Some of those are very powerful and some of them work very, very well. But if you're interested in using those drugs, then certainly I would consult somebody that has training in traditional Oriental medicine. Okay, they don't have the experience with that FDA procedure, but what do they have backing them? What do they have to rely on? Thousands of years of experience, that's right. So that's much better than just reading a newspaper article or something trying to educate yourself about herbal medicines, right? So try to get talk to somebody that has training in that particular field, right? And that's something we don't really talk much about in this class, right? But still, that's a very important kind of medicine to be aware of. Western medicine as opposed to Oriental medicine. Okay, and here's a topic that we cover in lab, and it relates to Western medicine and probably more so even to Oriental medicine, and this is this term homeostasis. Homeo means the same, and stasis means staying the same. And there are a number of parameters in our body that are regulated within a range that's suitable to support life. And we talked about body temperature. So for instance, are you the temperature that we find in this room right here? Because what's your body temperature? Probably 98 point something, 98.6, 98.8. Okay, and the room temperature here is probably in the 70s. It's really nice. Okay. So you're vastly different than the environment. Right? So your body temperature doesn't fluctuate. There are a number of other important parameters inside your body, your internal environment, that is different from the outside environment as well. And what are some of these things? Pressure. Okay? The pressure in your circulatory system is a lot different than the atmospheric pressure in the room right here. Right? The pH. Does anybody know what pH is in here? What is it? It's a measure of something. What's it a measure of? Acidity or alkalinity of your body, and we'll see what that really means in the next couple of lectures, but it's the acidity of your body. It's regulated as well. Let's see, your pH is about 7.34, and that can vary a little bit. Say if it dropped from 7.34 to 7.3, 7.29 in a matter of minutes, it would probably be lethal. So your body is regulated in terms of pH very tightly. You can't change very much. Over a long period of time, your pH can wander a little bit. It could get that acidic, but your body would need time to compensate for that. Fluids. Your body has to regulate fluids. And many other factors of the internal environment are maintained within a range of values suitable to support life. Now, this is the funny kind of statement. And that is that your body temperature is not exactly 98.8 every second of your life. So for instance, if you started to run up and down these stairs, guess what would happen to your body temperature? It would increase. Okay? So body temperature fluctuates, but how is it going to fluctuate? Not wildly. It's going to fluctuate just a little bit on one side or the other of that optimal temperature, because other things are going to kick into play to bring your body temperature back to where it should be. So for instance, if you start running up and down the stairs, your body temperature increases, what's going to happen to you? You're going to start sweating, okay? That evaporation of that water is going to cool your body down back to where it should be, right? But now what about your water balance? Yeah, you're dropping your water, so eventually what are you going to have to do? You're going to have that sensation that you're thirsty, right? So you're going to drink water. That's going to bring your water balance back up, right? And if you drink ice-cold water, that's going to drop your body temperature. Other mechanisms then will work to bring your body temperature back up while maintaining your water balance. So that's just two parameters, and your body is doing this constantly with thousands of parameters all the time, Okay, so all these parameters are dancing around each other so that none go wildly off scale one way or the other. So that's really what homeostasis means, is that these parameters are not absolutely constant. They're all changing, but they're all changing in just little bits, little degrees, so that nothing has to change by a lot. So that's what we mean by this dynamic state. Okay, so a dynamic state means everything is changing. The body systems are working and constantly adjusting to the changing internal and external conditions so that you're more or less constant. Not completely constant on the inside, but more or less. And I kind of think of a number of Star Trek episodes. If somebody ever got sick and went to sick bay, what was the name of the vessel that they traveled around on? Let's see if I'm talking about the same program. Star Trek. Anybody see Star Trek, or is you guys are too young for that? You've seen Star Trek, like the original series. It was what? The Enterprise, right? Starship Enterprise, and let's see, there was, who was the doctor? That was McCoy, I think, was the doctor, right? And if anybody was in sickbay, they'd have him on this gurney. And at the head of the gurney, let's put the gurney right here, at the head of the gurney, they had a display, right? And all these arrows. And some of them, you couldn't see what they were pointing to, but some was probably pH, respiratory rate, heart rate, blood pressure, okay? And what could you tell me about these arrows? What were they doing? Were they just pointing? Which was cool, was that these arrows were always doing what? They were always moving up and down, right? So all of these parameters, and this is how I think of homeostasis, all those parameters were dancing around each other. So to me, homeostasis is like a dance of all these different parameters changing around each other, right? So if the patient was kind of healthy, they'd be dancing around, but every once in a while, what would happen? They'd all go down here and stay right here, and then the sound would come on. And then probably the famous line in Star Trek of the doctor talking to Captain Kirk was what? He's dead, Jim. Right, that was like the famous line. Whenever somebody got killed, oh, he's dead, Jim. So when would the patient die? When what would happen? When homeostasis was lost, right? When all these parameters stopped dancing around each other, that's when you lose homeostasis, and of course that leads to a disease state, and then that leads to death. Okay, so homeostasis, you'll have to read various kinds of accounts to it before you really get it in an innate feeling of for what it really means. Okay, let me talk about some signaling molecules. When did we start? Started at 2? 2 to 3:20. Okay. Okay, signaling molecules are ways that your different parts of your body can communicate with other kinds of cells or other parts of your body through chemical messengers. And so we call these signaling molecules, and there's different kinds depending on what they do, and the kinds of signaling mechanisms that are used are classified a little bit differently. So I wanted to give you this slide right here. I don't believe this slide is in your book, but you'll get a hard copy of it maybe Wednesday, or it's on the internet already for you. Okay. So for instance, if here we have a signaling cell that wants to communicate with a distant tissue, and we call that a target cell, right? That could be meters away, right, very, very long distance. This hormone-secreting cell can secrete a hormone. This is just a molecule that can dissolve in the blood, and it gets absorbed by a blood vessel. And when it's in that blood vessel, where does it go? All over the body, right? It gets delivered wherever the blood is going. So this cell right here could be in your brain, and the blood is going to deliver this hormone all the way maybe to your little toe, for instance, right, because of the circulatory system. All right, so that's pretty long range. So hormones are used for long range communication, but the bridge between the secreting cell and the target cell is what? This blood vessel. All right, so this would be a typical endocrine kind of reflex. So a hormone is secreted by an endocrine gland because the hormone is picked up and distributed by a blood vessel. Okay. Another kind of reflex is if we have a neuron right here. A neuron can secrete a signaling molecule. from the end of this axon right here, and that chemical can diffuse someplace and it can stimulate another neuron or maybe some other kind of cell that's going to produce a response. We call that an effector cell. So this kind of chemical that is released by a neuron is what we call a neurotransmitter. And the neurotransmitter is just going to move by diffusion to another cell. So neuro is pretty easy to see. That comes from where? Because the cell that's secreting it is a neuron. Okay, but in this class, we're going to be familiar with a third kind of signaling mechanism, and that is here we have another nerve cell, right, similar to this first one that we see right here. It's going to release a chemical signaling molecule, but in this particular case, it's not going to move by diffusion to another neuron or effector cell. It's actually going to be picked up by the circulatory system, and once it's in the circulatory system, where does it go? Everywhere in the body. Okay, so the question is, what do we call that signaling molecule? Is it a neurotransmitter or is it a hormone? Well, it has characteristics of what? Both, right? So we can't just call it a hormone. It is a hormone, but it's also a neurotransmitter. So the best way to talk about that particular signaling molecule is that it is a neurohormone. And in a lot of advanced classes, we don't study the nervous system by itself. We don't study the endocrine system by itself. We study them together as one system, and that would be called the neuroendocrine system. All right, so don't forget, a neurohormone is secreted by a neuron, but it gets distributed by a blood vessel all over the body. Okay, to a target tissue someplace. Okay, short range kinds of controls. Sometimes we call this local control. And we have a couple other different kinds of signaling molecules. So if we have a cell that's going to be releasing a signaling molecule and it goes to a nearby target cell, we just call that a paracrine agent. Okay? Why don't we want to call this an endocrine agent? What's the distinction here between an endocrine agent, which is what we call a hormone, versus this paracrine right here? What is missing from this scheme? It doesn't go into a circulatory system, right? So there's no blood vessel that's necessary for transmitting this particular chemical around. Right? We also have something called an autocrine agent. An autocrine is secreted from some cell someplace, but it doesn't have to go anywhere. It goes back to the original cell and causes a response in the original cell. We call that an autocrine. And again, it doesn't need a blood vessel to go anywhere. Right, so paracrine goes from one cell to another. An autocrine affects the same cell that has secreted it. Okay, so these are just some examples and definitions that we're going to be utilizing that are important for maintaining homeostasis in our body. So homeostasis has two different ways that it can affect a system. There's something called negative feedback and something called positive feedback. And it's kind of loaded terms. So negative feedback is some kind of mechanism in your body by which any change from a normal ideal value is made smaller or is resisted. That's done by some kind of negative feedback mechanism. So for instance, when your body temperature increases and you start to sweat and your body temperature comes down, that's due to negative feedback. Right? So that negative feedback maintains homeostasis in your body. So negative feedback produces a healthy state. So negative feedback is what is normally producing a healthy circumstance in your body. So even though it's negative, what kind of connotation should it have for you? It really should be good, right? Because negative feedback maintains a healthy internal state for you, something that can maintain life. Positive feedback, on the other hand, is a body mechanism by which any change from an ideal normal value is made greater. So for instance, what would be an example of that? If your body temperature increased, right, positive feedback would mean what? Your body temperature would get hotter. right? And if positive feedback was still operating, what would happen to your body temperature? It would get hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter, and then what would happen? We'd explode into flames, okay? Almost, not quite. I've never seen that happen, okay? But that would be positive feedback. But hyperthermia is very real, and people do die, all right, if their body temperature goes too high, usually as a result of positive feedback mechanisms that aren't corrected. All right, so these are disease state mechanisms. All right, so positive feedback leads to a decompensated disease state and eventually to death. There's only a couple feedback mechanisms in our bodies that rely on positive feedback that are normal, healthy circumstances. And at the end of the class, we'll probably mention some of these, but one that I'll mention is parturition. What's parturition? Parturition is giving birth, childbirth, okay? And parturition is built on positive feedback, okay? And parturition really is controlled by the fetus, right? When the fetus gets really uncomfortable inside the uterus because the fetus has gotten really, really big and cramped, its stress level goes up and starts to secrete a hormone, ACTH, right? And that influences the mom to release oxytocin. And oxytocin is a chemical that causes smooth muscle to contract. Right? So what muscle is going to contract now? The uterus. So what happens to the unborn child when the uterus contracts? Is it more stressed or less stressed? More stress. All right? Which then causes the mother's the mother's uterus to contract, which does what to the condition of the fetus? More stress, which causes more uterine contractions, which causes more stress, more contractions, more stress, more contractions. Eventually, what happens? Baby comes out. Okay? So in that particular circumstance, positive feedback is a good, normal, healthy circumstance, but it doesn't go on forever, right? Something catastrophic happens, right? And that is delivery of the child. So there's a couple circumstances like that in the body, but not very many. We're probably going to learn maybe three or four. Most healthy feedback mechanisms are what? Negative feedback mechanisms. Okay. So homeostasis is the maintenance of a state of what we call dynamic constancy, in which parameters or conditions are stabilized within a range, okay, above or below what we call a physiologic set point. Okay, so the concept of set point is real important. And the PowerPoints that I have for you in lab will really build, I think, on to these concepts that we're talking about in lecture right here. So make sure you pay good, close attention to them in lab. All right, so a set point. What is the numerical value of that set point for body temperature? Okay, that's the ideal temperature. Yeah, 98.6 or 98.8, whatever it is. Okay, that would be the set point. And your body's temperature will fluctuate above and below that set point, but this variation about that set point should be what we call the normal range, and that's suitable to support your life. All right, so for instance, when your body temperature is above the set point, a nice negative feedback mechanism will be started, namely sweating, to decrease your body temperature, and it's going to cool down. And it might undershoot this set point right here, and your body temperature might get a little cold. And what's going to happen then? You're going to shiver, right? You're going to stop sweating. You might feel cold, put on a sweater, but your body will be able to take care of itself, right? So you'll stop sweating and you'll start shivering, and that muscle activity will increase your body temperature. Okay. So I think this shows you what homeostasis is. Right? It's not a flat line right at the set point. It's a variation, right? Slight variations around the set point, which is the ideal normal value. But not just for temperature, but for many other things. So what we have on this slide right here is what we call a response loop. So I want you to know the components of a response loop and how it affects homeostasis. All right, so in order for you to appreciate something, what you need to have on your body or in your body. Like if you want to perceive light, what do you need? You need eyes, right? If you want to appreciate sound, you need ears. And if you want to appreciate temperature, you need temperature sensors. And you have temperature sensors all over your body. That's a nice general sense. If I put an ice cube on your kneecap, you can say what? Oh, that's cold. If I put it on your back, you can say, oh, that's cold. So you have temperature sensors all over on the outside of your body plus on the inside. So the first part of a response loop in terms of anatomy is a sensor. So if you are going to measure the acidity of your body, guess what you need to have in your body? A pH receptor. Right? If you want to measure the salt concentration of your body, you need to have a receptor that measures salt. And indeed, we all do have those things, right? Those are sensors. Okay. So what is a sensor going to be sensitive to? It's going to be sensitive to this thing right here, this X. This is what we call a stimulus. So a proper stimulus has to affect a receptor or a sensor in the proper way. So that sensor or receptor is going to send information, okay, to your brain. And that's what the integration center is. So the integration center is someplace that's going to get information from this receptor or this sensor right here. And you could probably tell me right now, because you've all had anatomy, how does this information from a receptor or a sensor get into the central nervous system? It's a pathway. What kind of pathway is that? Close. It is the afferent pathway, afferent or sensory pathway. So sensory and afferent are exactly the same. So that first arrow right there is an afferent pathway, and there are various afferent pathways, and they're going to go to various centers of your brain. Good place to go probably for most cases might be like the medulla oblongata. Okay, in the cardioregulatory center there for monitoring blood pressure, for instance. All right, and in this integration center, this is where the set point is stored. So the sensor, so the integration center is going to be comparing the information coming from the receptor to the set point, and if the information is the same, right, if the set point is equal to what the sensor is reporting, what does the integration center have to do? Okay, if the set point is equal to, right, the stimulus, what does your body have to do? If the stimulus is, if the sensor is saying your body temperature is 98.8 and the set point is 98.8, what does the integration center have to do? Nothing. It's happy because you're exactly the way you should be. I'm not sure what's after this class, if it's math or not. I'm not sure. Second floor, there are people up there that would be able to tell you in the division office. Sorry. Okay. But if there's a deviation, then the integration center has got to make a decision on what to do to correct that deviation from normal. Okay. And so it sends its decision out through this pathway right here to an effector. Right. And that effector is going to produce some kind of response. So this X right here means stimulus. This one down over here means response. And what would we label this arrow right here? That would be the efferent pathway. Right? So afferent or sensory brings information into the brain. Motor or efferent pathway takes information from the central nervous system to an effector someplace. So all right, so let's just say, I don't know if I want to work this curve or not, but let's just say that this sensor is monitoring temperature, and the temperature is cold. What's the integration center going to do? It's going to say, well, there's an error. I better do something because my body's getting too cold. I'm going to send signals to, what's the effector in this particular case? Muscle to contract. That's going to increase your body temperature. All right, so the response, all right, is going to be in the opposite direction from the stimulus. All right, so if they subtract from each other, if the response subtracts from the stimulus, We call that negative feedback because they subtract from each other. If the response adds to the stimulus, what kind of feedback is that? Positive, right? So if the response adds to the stimulus that's positive, that's going to drive the parameter farther and farther away from the set point. Okay? So that's why it produces a disease state. Okay. So the other PowerPoints go over this response loop in another nice way. Okay. Let's talk about some other aspects of homeostasis. There are different ways that we can talk about regulatory mechanisms. One is intrinsic. Intrinsic control is built into the organ that's being regulated. It doesn't need anything else. And an important intrinsic control that we're going to look at is how the heart regulates itself, okay, to pump blood. And as more blood gets put into the heart, what do you think? Should the heart get weaker or should it get stronger to pump more blood? It should get stronger. And indeed, that's the normal circumstance. As more blood returns from your body and fills the heart up, it beats with more vigor and it pumps the blood out. All right, so we call that intrinsic control. Extrinsic control, right, means that other parts of your body are necessary to establish that control mechanism. Okay, so a good example of extrinsic control would be body temperature. It's controlled by antagonistic effects of both sweating and shivering. So in order to maintain body temperature, you need what? You need muscles in one part of your body, and you need sweat glands in a totally different part of your body. So if a sweat gland is going to maintain body temperature, it also needs what? It also needs muscles to do that in order to remain at a set point. So it's an interplay of this extrinsic mechanism. Sweat glands by themselves cannot regulate their temperature, right? They have to have help from other parts of the body, including what? The nervous system, okay? Like the efferent pathway and the afferent pathways and sensors and all that kind of stuff. But the heart by itself can auto-regulate to a large degree. Okay, another extrinsic mechanism is that if we look at a graph right here, this graph is going to show glucose concentration in blood. So this is blood glucose concentration versus time right here. We can measure blood glucose concentration over a day or over a number of minutes or whatever. And your body regulates glucose concentration to a large degree by a hormone that's called insulin. Okay? And we can artificially disrupt this system right here by injecting insulin. And this is actually a pretty normal, healthy individual right here that has normal blood glucose levels. But if we were to inject insulin into this individual, what happens to blood glucose levels? Okay, look, it drops. Okay, and then what does it do? It gradually goes back up into the normal range. Okay, so what is happening here is that the organ system that we're concerned with right here is the blood. Okay, and the reason why blood glucose starts to drop like this is not anything that's having to do with the blood, is that insulin is a signal that allows other cells in the body to take up glucose from the blood. And when other tissues in your body take glucose from the blood, what happens to blood glucose concentration? It goes down. All right, so what's regulating blood glucose right here is not just the blood itself, but it's also related to all the other cells that are in the body. And then how does blood glucose concentration recover? Right? Again, it has really nothing to do with the blood itself, but it has to do with the liver, another organ that is outside that initial organ system that we were looking at. Okay, so the liver then starts to manufacture glucose and put that glucose back in the blood to bring it back up to normal. All right, so that would be another extrinsic control. Okay, so positive feedback is rare because it does what? It amplifies changes. It makes changes greater When your environment should be relatively constant, positive feedback makes it greater. And, oh, here's a list of some important mechanisms that are healthy if they behave correctly in the body, that are positive feedback, but here are three cases of positive feedback that are normal under certain circumstances. It's involved in producing blood clots. So, for instance, when would that be a good positive thing to have? Blood clots? When? You perforate a blood vessel, like you get a paper cut, a deep paper cut on your finger, and you start to bleed. Okay? That blood clot. Now, where do you want that blood clot? Only just right there on your finger. You don't want that blood clot anywhere else in your body, right? So, nice positive feedback mechanism will stop that bleeding in the fingertip very quickly. But there are other mechanisms to make sure that that blood clot doesn't progress and go to other parts of your body. Because what would happen to you if all of your blood coagulated? Well, that would be the end of you, right? Okay. So that's pretty important. All right. In females, it's used to create a surge in luteinizing hormone. And that's a hormone that causes ovulation. That's due to a positive feedback mechanism, which we'll probably look at in the last week of this class. So I don't know if you can relate to that at all, but probably you can relate to ovulation. How often does ovulation happen? Once a month, right? Okay, too often, some people might say. Okay, and that is controlled by this particular hormone right here called luteinizing hormone. Okay, another positive feedback mechanism, oh, we talked about this already, caused during what? Parturition. Okay. And we'll probably talk about some of these mechanisms during this course. Some important negative feedback loops control blood pressure. So where should we start? Let's start right here. Blood pressure falls. All right, that's the stimulus. And in order to pick up that stimulus, what do we need in our body? We need a sensor. And in this particular case, a sensor that measures blood pressure is called people that went to lab know, but not everybody in class, it's called a baroreceptor. So, because how would, when you listen to the news tonight and listen to the weather report, how do they tell you about the pressure, the air pressure? Barometric pressure, right? So anytime you hear baro, you should be thinking of pressure, the barometric pressure. So a baroreceptor is a pressure sensor that we have in a couple places of our body, okay, and it's going to send that pressure information via afferent neurons to the medulla oblongata. And there's the vasomotor center and cardioregulatory center in the medulla oblongata. That's the integration center. What does the integration center have that allows it to make a decision on what to do with your body? There's something that resides in the integration center. That's a good test question. It's called the set point. It's your normal pressure, what your normal body pressure should be. Okay. Oh, guess what? I think I need to go get a glass of water, but it's time to cut off the class anyway. So, try to get on Blackboard.